Lincoln, Disc 21.
In the following weeks, Lincoln repeatedly argued the issue of emancipation in his own mind. To help clarify his thinking, he summoned his old Illinois friend Leonard Swett to the White House and carefully reviewed with him all the arguments for and against an Emancipation Proclamation. Reading some of the correspondence he'd received on both sides of the question, his manner didn't indicate that he wished to impress his views upon his hearer, Swett later recalled, but rather to weigh and examine them for his own enlightenment in the presence of his hearer. So neutral was the president's presentation that Swett, after the interview, wrote confidently to his wife, "He'll issue no proclamation emancipating Negroes." Lincoln's actions appeared to confirm Swett's prediction, for he stubbornly refused to commit his administration, even indirectly, to a policy of emancipation. On the vexed question of enlisting African Americans in the Union armies, strongly advocated by abolitionists as a matter of principle, and supported by many Northern governors as an expedient way of filling their military quotas, he remained resolutely negative, though willing, in common humanity, to insist that African Americans who fled to the lines of the Union armies mustn't suffer for want of food, shelter, or other necessaries of life. He was not ready to enroll them in the army. He wasn't sure that the freed men would fight, and he feared that guns placed in their hands would promptly fall into the hands of the Confederates. Besides, he told Browning, arming the blacks would produce dangerous and fatal dissatisfactions in our army and do more injury than good. Though Sumner repeatedly pressed him on this issue, arguing that by enlisting black soldiers, the rear guard of the rebellion would be changed into the advance guard of the Union, Lincoln continued to resist, saying that half the army would lay down their arms and three other states would join the rebellion. So strongly did he feel on this matter that when a delegation of Western politicians insistently urged him to accept Negro regiments, Lincoln grew impatient and finally exclaimed, "Gentlemen, you have my decision. I've made my mind up deliberately and mean to adhere to it. If the people are dissatisfied, I'll resign and let Mr. Hamlin try it." But at the same time, Lincoln began preparing public opinion for a proclamation of freedom, if one was to be issued. Because one of the chief objections to emancipation was the widespread belief that whites and blacks could never live together harmoniously, he revived his long-cherished idea of colonizing free blacks outside the United States. On August 14th, he summoned a delegation of African American leaders to the White House in order to discuss future relations between blacks and whites. "You and we are different races," he reminded them. "We've between us a broader difference than exists between almost any other two races." Nowhere in America were blacks treated as equals of whites. "It's better for us both, therefore, to be separated," he concluded, and he urged these blacks to take the lead by accepting government aid and forming a colony in Central America. If he could find 100, or even 50, or 25 able-bodied men with a mixture of women and children, he could make a successful beginning of the colonization project. Earnestly, he besought the leaders before him to consider his plan not as pertaining to yourselves merely, nor for your race and ours for the present time, but as one of the things, if successfully managed, for the good of mankind. Lincoln's proposal was promptly and emphatically rejected by most black spokesmen. The words of the president, declared the editor of the Pacific Appeal, an influential black newspaper, made it evident that he, his cabinet, and most of the people care but little for justice to the Negro. If necessary, he is to be crushed between the upper and nether millstone, the pride and prejudice of the North and South. Nor did it win support from white anti-slavery leaders. How much better would be a manly protest against prejudice against color, and a wise effort to give free men homes in America, Chase wrote in his diary. Abolitionist critics of the president's short-sighted racial views failed to note that this was the first occasion in American history when a president received a delegation of African Americans in the White House. They also didn't realize that some influential African American leaders, like the Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, who understood that Lincoln's purpose was to save our emancipated brethren from being returned to their former condition of slavery, supported his initiative as the most humane and merciful movement which this or any other administration has proposed for the benefit of the enslaved. Lincoln's critics, white or black, also didn't understand that the president's plea for colonization, heartfelt and genuine as it was also a shrewd political move, a bit of careful preparation for an eventual Emancipation Proclamation. No doubt he expected his proposal to be rejected. But he knew that a plan for the voluntary removal of blacks from the country would make emancipation more palatable to the border states and also relieve Northerners of a fear that they would be inundated by a migration of free Negroes from the South. Shortly afterward, Lincoln took a further step to prepare public opinion by publishing a reply to an intemperate editorial by Horace Greeley in the New York Tribune called The Prayer of 20 Millions. To Greeley's complaint that he was strangely and disastrously remiss in not proclaiming emancipation, as required by the Second Confiscation Act, and the editor's charge that it was preposterous and futile to try to put down the rebellion without eradicating slavery, Lincoln replied, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I'd do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I'd do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union." Written at a time when the draft of the Emancipation Proclamation had already been completed, Lincoln's letter to Greeley later seemed puzzling, if not deceptive. But the president didn't intend it to be so. He was giving assurance to the large majority of the Northern people who didn't want to see the war transformed into a crusade for abolition, and at the same time he was alerting anti-slavery men that he was contemplating further moves against the peculiar institution. In Lincoln's mind, there was no necessary disjunction between a war for the Union and a war to end slavery. Like most Republicans, he had long held the belief that if slavery could be contained, it would inevitably die. A war that kept the slave states within the Union would, therefore, bring about the ultimate extinction of slavery. For this reason, saving the Union was his paramount object. But readers, aware that Lincoln always chose his words carefully, should have recognized that paramount meant foremost or principal, not sole. Widely published in Northern newspapers, Lincoln's letter to Greeley received universal approval. "It'll clear the atmosphere and gives ground to stand on," Thurlow Weed judged. "The triumphant manner in which you've so modestly and so clearly set forth the justification of your fixed purposes," George Ashman told the president, "dispels all doubts of the expediency and wisdom of your course. It's the best enunciation of the best platform we've had since the Chicago Convention adjourned," wrote Senator Timothy O. Howe of Wisconsin. "Whatever is honest and earnest in the nation will march to that music." Almost unnoted in the chorus of praise were the phrases in Lincoln's letter reaffirming his oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free, and promising that he would adopt new views so fast as they shall appear to be true views. But he couldn't announce new views nor act on his personal convictions yet. The draft of his Emancipation Proclamation lay locked in a drawer. Every now and then he took it out and, as he recalled later, added or changed a line, touching it up here and there, anxiously watching the progress of events. But he needed a victory. Victory didn't come. Throughout July, McClellan's huge army sweltered on the peninsula, its commander unable to take the offensive and unwilling to withdraw. The general was furious that Halleck, and not he, had been named general-in-chief, and he spent much of his time brooding over the insult that Lincoln and Stanton had inflicted on him. He'd learned of Halleck's appointment from the newspapers. He complained that Lincoln had acted so as to make the matter as offensive as possible. "He has not shown the slightest gentlemanly or friendly feeling, and I can't regard him as, in any respect, my friend. I'm confident that he'd relieve me tomorrow if he dared do so," he told his wife. "His cowardice alone prevents it." For his part, Lincoln had concluded that McClellan never would fight. If by magic he could reinforce McClellan with 100,000 men today, he remarked to Browning, he'd be in an ecstasy over it, thank him for it, and tell him he'd go to Richmond tomorrow, but that when tomorrow came, he'd telegraph that he had certain information that the enemy had 400,000 men and that he couldn't advance without reinforcements. The president informed Halleck, now in command of all the armies, that he could keep McClellan at the head of the Army of the Potomac or remove him as he pleased. He promptly got an unwelcome insight into the character of his new general-in-chief. Halleck had arrived in Washington with a reputation as a broadly informed student of the art of war and an experienced commander of armies that had won victories from the Confederates in the West. But the general, who was called Old Brains because he'd been a professor at West Point, had more experience with theories of warfare than with realities of military politics. When it dawned upon him that Lincoln, Stanton, and some other members of the cabinet sought to have him take the blame for removing McClellan, he shied away. "They want me to do what they're afraid to attempt," he wrote his wife. even after Lincoln sent him down to the James to inspect the army himself, Halleck seemed incapable of exercising the authority the president had vested in him. Repeatedly, Halleck urged, begged, cajoled, and ordered McClellan to move his army from the peninsula back to the vicinity of Washington, where he'd be in a position to reinforce Pope's advancing army. All was slow. McClellan had no interest in assisting his arch rival and dragged his feet, while Halleck wrung his hands. "I'm almost broken down," the general-in-chief complained. "I can't get General McClellan to do what I wish." With McClellan apparently immovable on the peninsula, the hope for Union victory rested with John Pope's Army of Virginia, now advancing south of Manassas. Lincoln closely watched Pope's progress. He wasn't discouraged when Stonewall Jackson checked his advance at Cedar Mountain on August 9th, but he again urged McClellan to speed his departure from the James in order to be able to reinforce Pope. Even after Lee, rightly judging that McClellan's army no longer posed a threat to Richmond, dispatched General James Longstreet's corps to assist Jackson, and threw the strength of the full Army of Northern Virginia on Pope's forces in the Second Battle of Bull Run, the president remained optimistic. During the first 2 days of the fighting, August 28th and 29th, he spent most of his time in the telegraph office of the War Department and closely monitored the dispatches from the front. On August 30th, he was relaxed enough to attend an informal supper at Stanton's house, presided over by the secretary's pretty wife, as white and cold and motionless as marble, whose rare smiles seemed to pain her. Stanton assured the president that nothing but foul play could lose us this battle. And after dinner at the War Department, Halleck also exuded quiet confidence. Lincoln retired, expecting to receive news of victory in the morning. His new plan for a hard, decisive war against the Confederacy was about to succeed. But at about 8 in the evening, he came to Hayes' room with the news he'd just received. "Well, John, we're whipped again, I'm afraid." Pope had been defeated and forced back to Centerville, where he reported he would be able to hold his men. "I don't like that expression," Lincoln said, doubtless recalling dozens of similar messages he'd received from McClellan. "I don't like to hear him admit that his men need holding." Though the news was all bad, Lincoln wasn't in despair and hoped to resume the offensive. "We must hurt this enemy before it gets away," he kept saying. "We must whip these people now." By the next morning, he'd absorbed the full extent of Pope's defeat. Once again, Confederate troops threatened Washington. Once again, every hospital bed in the capital was filled with the wounded, and the streets of the city were crowded with stragglers and deserters. Though the Union soldiers, who had fought bravely, were less demoralized than after the first battle of Bull Run, their commanders were more so. Pope denounced McClellan for failing to reinforce him and urged courts-martial for Generals Fitzjohn Porter and William B. Franklin. While the generals bickered, the army, in disarray, retreated to the outskirts of the capital. Exhausted from long hours spent in the telegraph office attempting to learn the news and trying to speed reinforcements to Pope's army, Lincoln fell into a deep depression. Once again, his plans had all failed. The strenuous, aggressive war that, in theory, should have resulted in the defeat of Lee's army and the capture of the Confederate capital, had aborted. With its failure disappeared Lincoln's opportunity to issue a proclamation abolishing slavery, the cause of the war. Nothing that Lincoln did, it seemed, could speed Union victory. Again, the president returned to his bleak, fatalistic philosophy. "I'm almost ready to say that God wills this contest and wills that it shall not end yet," he wrote in an informal memorandum to himself. After all, God could have either saved or destroyed the Union without a human contest, yet he allowed the war to begin. And having begun, he could give the final victory to either side any day. Yet the contest proceeds. In the present Civil War, Lincoln echoed his old doctrine of necessity, it's quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party. Consequently, as he explained to an English Quaker a few weeks later, he had to believe that he permits the war for some wise purpose of his own, mysterious and unknown to us. With great reluctance, the president abandoned the idea of waging an aggressive war against the Confederacy and returned to a defensive posture. With this reversal of policy, he looked again to the indispensable man, McClellan. By this time, Lincoln harbored no illusions about the general. He thought McClellan was the chief alarmist and grand marplot of the army, ridiculed his weak, whiny, vague, and incorrect dispatches, and considered his failure to reinforce Pope unpardonable. Yet he knew that McClellan was a superb organizer and an efficient engineer. And, what was equally important, he recognized that nothing but the reinstatement of McClellan would restore the shattered morale of the Army of the Potomac. "I must have McClellan to reorganize the army and bring it out of chaos," he concluded, adding, "McClellan has the army with him." Without consulting any of his advisors, and merely informing Halleck of his decision, the president asked McClellan to take command of the troops that were falling back into Washington and to defend the Capitol. Mad as a March hare over what he considered repeated snubs, McClellan accepted the assignment with reluctance, and only after he had a pretty plain talk with Lincoln and Halleck about his new responsibilities. "I only consent to take it for my country's sake, and with the humble hope that God has called me to it," he explained to his wife. Lincoln moved without consulting his advisors because he was aware that nearly all the members of his cabinet shared his reservations about McClellan. Hearing rumors that McClellan might be recalled to command, Stanton, in great excitement, told Welles that he could not and would not submit to a continuance of this state of things. When reminded that the president alone had the final say in selecting a general, he said he knew of no particular obligations he was under to the president who'd called him to a difficult position and imposed upon him labors and responsibilities which no man could carry and which were greatly increased by fastening upon him a commander who was constantly striving to embarrass him in his administration of the War Department. Together with Chase, Stanton drew up a written protest, charging that McClellan was an incompetent and probably a traitor, and he tried to get other members of the cabinet to sign it. Smith agreed to do so. In the hope of getting as many cabinet signatures as possible, Stanton and Chase permitted Bates to tone down the protest to read that it was not safe to entrust to Major General McClellan the command of any of the armies of the United States. And the Attorney General then signed. But Wells refused to join the others. He agreed that McClellan's removal from command was demanded by public sentiment and the best interest of the country, but he thought the remonstrance discourteous and disrespectful to the president. Already wrung by the bitterest anguish over the recent defeat, Lincoln was distraught when he received the memorial, and he told the cabinet that at times he felt almost ready to hang himself. He respected the earnest sincerity of his cabinet advisers who denounced the reinstatement of McClellan, and in face of their unanimous opposition, Seward was absent and Blair was silent, declared he would gladly resign his place, but he couldn't see who could do the work wanted as well as McClellan. "We must use what tools we have," he explained. Lincoln expected McClellan's role to be a temporary defensive one. But Lee, instead of resting after his victory at Second Bull Run, pushed across the Potomac and invaded Maryland. Initially, the president saw the invasion as an opportunity. "We could end the war by allowing the enemy to go to Harrisburg and Philadelphia," he believed. Far from his supplies and reinforcements, Lee could be readily defeated. But the approach of the Confederates had demoralized Pennsylvania state officials, and the militia was almost on the point of mutiny. Halleck insisted that only McClellan could turn back the invasion. Lincoln agreed reluctantly to restoring McClellan to permanent command, placing full responsibility on Halleck. "I could not have done it," the president explained to Wells, "for I can never feel confident that he'll do anything." Despite his reservations, Lincoln, during the next 2 weeks, did all he could to strengthen McClellan's army. To prevent the Army of the Potomac from being dispersed, he fended off urgent requests for aid from local authorities in the path of the Confederate invasion. He had to turn aside a plea from the excitable governor of Pennsylvania for 80,000 troops, reminding Curtin, "We haven't 80,000 disciplined troops, properly so called, this side of the mountains." He had also to convince panic-stricken mayors from Harrisburg, Philadelphia, and Baltimore that the best way to protect their cities was to keep the Union troops together in pursuit of Lee's army. The Confederate invasion of Maryland, coming so close after Lee's smashing victory at Second Bull Run, fanned criticism of the president and his conduct of the war. Recent events convinced George Templeton Strong that Lincoln, though an honest old codger, was simply unequal to his place. Old friends like Samuel Galloway of Ohio warned the president that this changing from McClellan to Pope and from Pope to McClellan creates distrust and uncertainty. Other critics were blunter. From Chicago, the Reverend Robert Laird Collier, a Methodist minister, issued a call for the moral heroism that the president obviously lacked. "Tale-telling and jesting illy suit the hour and become the man in whose hands the destiny of a great nation is trembling. Earnestness, unmixed and terrible, is the demand alike of the crisis and the people." Demands rose for a complete reorganization of the administration. Kentucky Senator Garrett Davis urged the president to fire both Stanton and Chase, the most sinister of all the cabinet. Others demanded that Lincoln oust McClellan. Chase condemned the president's humiliating submissiveness to the general and lamented that Lincoln, for all his true unselfish patriotism, had yielded so much to border state and negrophobic counsels that he now finds it difficult to arrest his own descent towards the most fatal concessions. Massachusetts Governor Andrew began trying, if possible, to save the president from the infamy of ruining his country, and he summoned a conference of his fellow war governors at Altoona, Pennsylvania, in late September. Caught in a crossfire, Lincoln had to reconsider his emancipation policy as well as his military strategy. The logical parallel to reinstating McClellan to fight a limited defensive war waged by professional armies was a return to his inaugural pledge not to interfere with slavery within the states. Many of his oldest and most loyal supporters urged exactly this policy, warning that a more radical policy would surely cost the Republicans support in the fall congressional elections. From Illinois, Browning, who was campaigning for the Republican candidates in that state, entreated him not to listen to the few very radical and extreme men who can think, nor talk, nor dream of anything but the Negro. If Lincoln held to a moderate course, Browning continued, he would have behind him not merely the members of his own party, but the Democrats, who are for you almost to a man, quite as near a unit in your support as the Republicans. More than once in the days after McClellan's return to command, Lincoln seemed to revert to this policy. On September 13th, when a delegation of Chicago Christians representing all denominations urged him to issue an emancipation order, he reminded them of the practical difficulties in the way of any attempt to free the slaves. He noted that the recent Confiscation Act hadn't caused a single slave to come over to us. What good would a proclamation of emancipation from me do? Especially as we are now situated, he asked. I don't want to issue a document that the whole world will see must necessarily be inoperative, like the Pope's bull against the comet. But Lincoln was under increasing pressure to act. His call for additional volunteers had met a slow response, and several of the northern governors bluntly declared that they couldn't meet their quotas unless the president moved against slavery. The approaching conference of northern war governors would almost certainly demand an emancipation proclamation. He also had to take seriously the insistent reports that European powers were close to recognizing the Confederacy and would surely act unless the United States government took a stand against slavery. Always reluctant to be out in front of public opinion, always hesitant to assume positions from which there could be no retreat, Lincoln deliberated long before making a hard choice. Ultimately, he chose to leave the decision to a higher power. To the Chicago Christians, who urged him to issue a proclamation of emancipation, he pledged, "It's my earnest desire to know the will of Providence in this matter, and if I can learn what it is, I'll do it." Seeking a sign, he closely monitored the news of Lee's invasion of Maryland and the reports from McClellan's pursuing army. As he told the cabinet later, he made a vow, a covenant, that if God gave us the victory in the approaching battle, he'd consider it an indication of divine will, and that it was his duty to move forward in the cause of emancipation. On September 17th, McClellan's victory at Antietam, though not the overwhelming success Lincoln had hoped for, gave the president the omen he'd sought. Turning back to his long-delayed proclamation of emancipation, Lincoln, as he said, fixed it up a little over the weekend and called the cabinet together on September 22nd to hear it. Now that the decision was made, he was more relaxed and at home with himself than he'd been for weeks. Partly, no doubt, to break the ice in the cabinet meeting, but chiefly because he wanted others to share his good humor, he began by reading a section titled High-Handed Outrage at Utica from a new book the humorist Artemus Ward had sent him. This bit of clownery about a big burly feller from that truly great city who saw a display of wax figures of the apostles at the Last Supper and caved in the head of the false apostle to prove that Judas Iscariot can't show hisself in Utica with impunity by a darn sight. The president found very funny. And except for the irascible Stanton, the other heads of departments also enjoyed it, or pretended to. The president then turned to business, reminding the cabinet of their earlier discussion of emancipation and of the reasons the proclamation had been delayed. "I think the time has come now," he told them. "I wish it were a better time. I wish that we were in a better condition." But now he could redeem the promise he'd made to himself and, he said, hesitating a little, to his Maker. He didn't seek their advice about the main matter, for that, he explained, he'd determined for himself. But he was willing to accept criticisms of any expressions used or any other minor matter. The document the president presented for cabinet consideration lacked the memorable rhetoric of his most notable utterances. The proclamation, in the words of the atrabilious Gurevsky, was written in the meanest and the most dry routine style. Not a word to evoke a generous thrill, not a word reflecting the warm and lofty feelings of the people. Totally absent was any reference to the barbarism of slavery, nor was morality invoked as a reason for striking it down. Instead, Lincoln cited as his authority for acting against slavery his powers as President of the United States of America and Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy thereof, and the provisions of both the First and Second Confiscation Acts. His sole announced purpose was the object of practically restoring the constitutional relation between the United States and each of the states and the people thereof. The president remained reluctant, even at this late hour, to offer unqualified freedom to the slaves. He promised to continue to press for compensated emancipation and for the colonization of African Americans outside the country. Yet for all his hesitation, Lincoln announced at the end that on January 1st, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or part of a state still in rebellion would be then, thenceforward, and forever free. In presenting the Emancipation Proclamation to the cabinet, Lincoln made it clear that he was as uncertain about its expediency as he was doubtful of its success. He was unsure how his new policy would be received. "I know very well that many others might in this matter, as in others, do better than I can," he told the cabinet. "And if I were satisfied that the public confidence was more fully possessed by any one of them than by me, and knew of any constitutional way in which he could be put in my place, he should have it. I'd gladly yield it to him. But since that wasn't possible, he concluded, I must do the best I can and bear the responsibility of taking the course which I feel I ought to take. In the discussion that followed, Seward proposed two minor verbal alterations in the document. Ponderously, Chase offered, The proclamation does not indeed mark out exactly the course I should myself prefer, but I'm ready to take it just as it's written, and to stand by it with all my heart. Only Blair expressed dissent, not because he opposed emancipation, but because he feared the proclamation would have a bad influence on the border states and the army, and that it might strengthen the Democrats in the fall congressional elections. Lincoln said that he'd considered the first of these dangers and discounted it. As for the second, he said, it hadn't much weight with him. Accordingly, the document was handed to the Secretary of State to be copied and officially published. 2 days later, responding to serenaders who came to the White House in celebration of the Emancipation Proclamation, the president revealed that he still felt uncertain about his action. I can only trust in God. I've made no mistake, he told the crowd. It's now for the country and the world to pass judgment on it. I'll say no more upon this subject. He concluded, lamely, In my position, I'm environed with difficulties. Chapter 14. A Pumpkin in Each End of My Bag. In time, Lincoln came to think of the Emancipation Proclamation as the crowning achievement of his administration. It was, he told his old Kentucky friend Joshua F. Speed, a measure that would ensure his fame by linking his name with something that would resound to the interest of his fellow man. But in the months immediately following the preliminary proclamation, he was much less sanguine. The proclamation threatened to break up the tenuous coalition of Republicans, war Democrats, and border state leaders that he had so carefully been building since the outbreak of the war. At the same time, it strengthened the peace element in the Democratic Party, and it seemed likely to provoke a mutiny in the army. During the 100 days after he issued the preliminary proclamation, Lincoln's leadership was more seriously threatened than at any other time, and it wasn't clear that his administration could survive the repeated crises that it faced. The initial Northern responses to the Emancipation Proclamation were predictable. Anti-slavery men were jubilant. God bless Abraham Lincoln, exclaimed Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. The president, announced Joseph Medill's Chicago Tribune, had promulgated the grandest proclamation ever issued by man. In every major city throughout the North, there were huge rallies to celebrate the proclamation, marked by bonfires, parades with torches and transparencies, and inevitably fountains of oratory. Scores of letters of commendation poured into the president's office. God bless you for the word you've spoken, wrote three correspondents from Erie, Pennsylvania. All good men upon the earth will glorify you, and all the angels in heaven will hold jubilee. The virtuous, the reflecting, the intelligently patriotic, as one man hail your edict with delight, the veteran Pennsylvania abolitionist J. M. McKim told the president, and they bless and thank God that he put it in your heart to issue it. A Baltimorean took an odd way of showing his enthusiasm for the proclamation by sending the president half a dozen hams. Nearly every notable man of letters, especially those from New England, voiced approval of the proclamation. John Greenleaf Whittier, William Cullen Bryant, and James Russell Lowell all wrote eloquently in its praise. Hitherto cool toward Lincoln, Ralph Waldo Emerson was now prepared to forget all that we thought shortcomings, every mistake, every delay, because the president had been permitted to do more for America than any other American man. For the moment, Lincoln's critics within his own party were silenced. Thaddeus Stevens and Benjamin F. Wade, both of whom had scathingly attacked Lincoln for his incompetence and for his slowness to move against slavery, had nothing to say. Charles Sumner, locked in a close contest in Massachusetts for re-election to the Senate, saw that the proclamation would help erase the doubts that his abolitionist supporters continued to feel toward Lincoln, and jubilantly announced that he stood with the loyal multitudes of the North firmly and sincerely by the side of the president. The governors of the northern states who gathered at Altoona in the hope of pushing Lincoln to prosecute the war more vigorously found that the president had preempted their ground, and somewhat lamely, their leaders trooped down to Washington to congratulate the president on his proclamation as a measure of justice and sound policy. No doubt such tributes were gratifying to a president who'd hitherto received little public praise, but Lincoln was too much of a realist to overestimate their importance. Commendation in newspapers and by distinguished individuals is all that a vain man could wish, he reported to Hannibal Hamlin. But he noted that subscriptions to government securities had fallen off and volunteering had dropped. The North responds to the proclamation sufficiently in breath, he told the vice president, but breath alone kills no rebels. In the South, so far as the president could determine, the reaction to the Emancipation Proclamation was altogether negative. Jefferson Davis denounced it as an attempt to stir up servile insurrection and called it a further reason why the Confederacy must fight for its independence. On Southern Unionism, the proclamation had a chilling effect. In Tennessee, Emerson Etheridge discovered in Lincoln's proclamation treachery to the Union men of the South. And Thomas A.R. Nelson, one of the most vigorous opponents of secession in eastern Tennessee, attacked the atrocity and barbarism of Mr. Lincoln's proclamation. Lincoln could learn little of its impact on African Americans in the South. Not until the war was over did they dare admit that they'd learned of impending emancipation through the grapevine and were preparing to escape to freedom at the first opportunity. Even more disappointing was the initial foreign reaction to the proclamation, for one of Lincoln's purposes had been to forestall threatened moves by Great Britain and France toward the recognition of the Confederacy. Eventually, immense throngs in London, Birmingham, and other British cities would rally to celebrate Lincoln's Declaration of Freedom, and an outraged public opinion would make it impossible for any British government to intervene on behalf of the slaveholding Confederacy. But the immediate foreign response was negative. Many were sure that the proclamation would be ineffective, since it applied only to slaves beyond the reach of Union arms, while doing nothing to free those behind Union lines. Others anticipated that it would incite a servile war. Lord John Russell, the British foreign minister, predicted acts of plunder, of incendiarism, and of revenge. As Seward had warned, many Europeans feared that emancipation might interfere with the cotton supply so necessary for British and French mills. Even in the North, once the initial euphoria had abated, the Emancipation Proclamation came under skeptical scrutiny. Abolitionists noted that Lincoln had only made a promise of freedom and that, apart from being conditional, his promise could be withdrawn before January 1st. A few even claimed that the proclamation postponed emancipation as required by the Second Confiscation Act. Recovering from his initial enthusiasm, Greeley lamented that Lincoln exempted from his decree most of Louisiana and Tennessee, two states which had more than 100,000 of their citizens in arms to destroy the Union. Similarly, William Lloyd Garrison regretted that the proclamation left slavery as a system still to exist in all the so-called loyal slave states. More troubling to the president was the disaffection the proclamation caused his moderate supporters. Some border state unionists believed that his action would undermine the loyalty of Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri. Conservative Republicans thought the proclamation unconstitutional and unwise. Orville H. Browning, one of Lincoln's oldest friends and one of the few in Washington in whom he'd hitherto confided freely, was so offended by it that he avoided discussing public issues with the president. Even some of the president's cabinet advisers regretted his proclamation. Seward loyally supported the president once he'd made his decision, but he continued to think that the Emancipation Decree was both unnecessary and ineffective. Montgomery Blair muffled his criticisms, but his sister accurately captured the feelings of the Blair clan when she called the proclamation a mistake, a paper pronunciamento, and of no practical result. Less significant was the muted opposition of Secretary of the Interior Caleb B. Smith, whose unhappiness with Lincoln's policies, together with ill health, caused him to resign in November. From the start, many Democrats were bitterly opposed to the proclamation. The New York World declared that Lincoln was now adrift on a current of radical fanaticism, terming the proclamation a violation of both the Constitution and the law of nations. The New York Evening Express called it an act of revolution, which would render the restoration of the old Constitution and Union impossible, while the New York Journal of Commerce predicted that the proclamation would lead to a continuation of the war in a dark future in which the end is beyond our vision. Much of the dissatisfaction with the Emancipation Proclamation was muted because the president, on September 24th, issued another proclamation which suspended the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus throughout the country and authorized the arbitrary arrest of any person guilty of any disloyal practice, affording aid and comfort to rebels against the authority of the United States. To the president, this seemed such a routine matter that he didn't even mention it to the cabinet. Stanton, as authorized by the Militia Act of July 17, 1862, had been issuing stringent orders to suppress criticism of the newly instituted draft. Enforced by petty officials all across the country, these regulations had resulted in hundreds of cases of violation of civil liberties. when civilians were subjected to arbitrary and often quite unreasonable arrests. Lincoln's proclamation was simply designed to codify these War Department rules. But Democrats, like Senator James A. Bayard of Delaware, read it to mean that the president was declaring himself a dictator. For that and nothing less it does. Whatever Lincoln's intent, the new proclamation had a chilling effect on public dissent. Editors feared that they might be locked up in Fort Lafayette or in the old Capitol prison in Washington if they voiced their criticisms too freely. And even writers of private letters began to guard their language. However muffled, the voice of the people found expression in the 1862 fall elections for governors and congressmen, in which the president's party suffered major reverses. The outcome was hardly surprising to Lincoln. After all, he'd been elected by a minority of the voters in 1860, and many of the Republican members of Congress chosen that year owed their seats to divisions among their opponents. As the war dragged on, the strength of the Democrats increased. Under Lincoln's leadership, Union armies seemed on occasion to be successful, but never victorious. The cost of the war in lives and suffering was appalling, and the president's call for 600,000 more men suggested that the endless drain was far from over. Meantime, the country's finances were in perilous shape, and the decision to resort to paper currency appeared to be an act of desperation. Throughout the early months of 1862, the president had received repeated warnings that his party was in trouble, and he anticipated losses in the fall elections when, as he wryly predicted to Carl Schurz, Democrats would fail to support his administration because it was too radical, and Republicans because it was not radical enough. Alarmed by the prospect, influential Republicans urged him to use his influence to strengthen the party. If only the president could be induced to employ his vast patronage to sustain his friends, John W. Forney, a Pennsylvania editor, lamented, this calamity of Democratic victory might be averted. To the chagrin of party leaders, he did nothing. He even refused to endorse his old friend Owen Lovejoy, who was in a fierce battle for re-election in his Illinois district. During the summer of 1862, the president was, of course, preoccupied with directing a vast military operation, but at no other time in Lincoln's life was he too busy for political management, at which he was so skilled. He held aloof from the congressional contests because there wasn't much he could do to influence their outcome. As a number of other chief executives have discovered, presidential coattails are of little use in off-year congressional elections. In any case, Lincoln realized that he was not a popular president. Indeed, he told the cabinet members in September, "I believe that I have not so much of the confidence of the people as I had some time since." The president also understood that intervention in a local or state race might involve him in bitter factional quarrels within his own party. In New York, for example, as able Governor E.D. Morgan was about to finish his term, Seward and Thurlow Weed sought to broaden the Republican Party into a union party and favored nominating the stalwart war Democrat General John A. Dix for governor. Constantly suspicious of Seward's conservatism and intent on pushing the anti-slavery agenda of the more radical wing of the Republican Party, Horace Greeley successfully pressed for the nomination of the earnest abolitionist General James S. Wadsworth. The contest weakened both Republican factions, and Wadsworth entered the fall campaign crippled by disaffection among Republican voters. To oppose him, New York Democrats nominated their ablest and most thoughtful spokesman, Horatio Seymour. In his home state of Illinois, the president did interfere, though less by design than by inadvertence. Illinois Republicans, alarmed earlier in the year by the narrowness of their success in defeating a Democratic new state constitution, joined a union fusion movement in which they said party lines and partisan feelings should be swallowed up in patriotism. As part of this strategy, they redrew the boundaries of the state's congressional districts. Sangamon, Lincoln's home county, always staunchly Democratic, was now linked with three other counties thought to be predictably Republican. The new district was expected to elect David Davis. But before Davis was nominated, Lincoln let it be known that he intended to appoint his old friend to a vacancy on the United States Supreme Court, a post that Davis coveted. Illinois Republicans were obliged to fall back on Leonard Swett, who, like Davis, had worked for Lincoln's nomination. To oppose Swett, the Democrats named John Todd Stewart, Lincoln's first law partner. Most congressional and gubernatorial nominations were made before Lincoln issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, but inevitably it became a key issue in all the Northern elections. In New England and in the states of the Upper Northwest, the proclamation strengthened the Republican Party, bringing back the support of disaffected abolitionists. "It is," wrote one Vermonter, "a document for an open sea and plain sailing." But elsewhere, as the president had anticipated, the result was decidedly negative. As a correspondent wrote Secretary Chase, "Democrats throughout the North now howled, 'I told you so. Can't you see this is an abolition war and nothing else?'" Expecting to lose Republican votes because of the emancipation issue, Lincoln was evidently surprised by the Democrats' effective use of a second issue, the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, announced in his proclamation of September 24th. Democrats seized on this proclamation as evidence that the president sought to make himself a dictator. The federal government, claimed the Democratic Illinois State Register, was seeking to inaugurate a reign of terror in the loyal states by military arrests of citizens without a trial, to browbeat all opposition by villainous and false charges of disloyalty against whole classes of patriotic citizens, to destroy all constitutional guarantees of free speech, a free press, and the writ of habeas corpus. This became the main theme of the Democratic campaign in New York when Horatio Seymour pledged that if arbitrary arrests continued after his election, he would resist, even if the streets be made to run red with blood. In Illinois, John Todd Stewart made effective use of the fear inspired by the proclamation to avoid debating his opponent, Swett. Stewart claimed that if either man in the course of a debate too freely expressed what he thought or felt, he might be arrested. As the October and November elections approached, the president looked to the outcome with great anxiety. Visitors thought he seemed literally bending under the weight of his burdens. His introverted look and his half-staggering gait, a Chicago woman wrote, were like those of a man walking in sleep, and his face revealed the ravages which care, anxiety, and overwork had wrought. ordinarily the master of his emotions, he let his self-control slip at times during these trying weeks. When Thomas H. Clay, Henry Clay's son, asked, as a favor, that a particular army division be reassigned to Kentucky for rest and relaxation, Lincoln snapped back a refusal. "I sincerely wish war was an easier and pleasanter business than it is, but it doesn't admit of holy days." His anxieties were warranted. When the votes were tallied, the president learned that the voters had administered to him and his party a severe rebuff. In state after state that had gone Republican in 1860, Democrats made huge gains: New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. New Jersey, which divided its electoral vote in 1860, now went Democratic. The Wisconsin delegation, formerly solidly Republican, was split. Major Republican leaders in the House of Representatives, including Roscoe Conkling of New York, John A. Bingham of Ohio, and even Speaker Galusha A. Groh of Pennsylvania, went down to defeat. The Democrats carried the president's home district in Illinois, electing Stewart over Sweat. The Republican Party retained control of the new House of Representatives in the 38th Congress, which wouldn't meet until December 1863, but its majority would be drastically reduced. In state elections, New Jersey elected Joel Parker, an able Democrat, as governor, and most serious of all from the point of view of the Lincoln administration, Seymour was chosen governor of New York. As the New York Times concluded, the elections, taken as a whole, amounted to a vote of want of confidence in the president. Disgruntled Republicans deluged the president with analyses of their defeats. In Illinois, Republican losses were attributed to an ill-timed order of Secretary Stanton, issued just days before the Emancipation Proclamation, for the resettlement of contrabands, temporarily housed in Cairo, on farms throughout the state. Democrats charged the administration was attempting to Africanize Illinois. Many Republicans found it comforting to believe that the Democrats won because so many Republicans of voting age were in the armies. And Lincoln himself argued that the Democrats were left in a majority by our friends going to the war. But there was little evidence to support this conclusion, since volunteering in Democratic counties was as heavy as in Republican counties. Others, like the astute New York lawyer David Dudley Field, attributed the outcome to the administration's policy of arbitrary arrests. "There was nobody to pronounce them legal," he told the president, "nobody to consider them expedient, even if they had been legal." Unless the administration abandoned the practice of arresting citizens without legal process, he warned, "there's every reason to fear that you'll be unable successfully to carry on the government." Lincoln didn't publicly admit that violations of civil liberties were responsible for Republican defeats, but the president, who'd given little personal attention to the issue of arbitrary arrests, even during the worst excesses of 1862, kept a closer eye on them in the following months. Without abandoning or diminishing his claim to extraordinary authority under the war powers, he began to formulate more careful rationalizations for the use of that authority. He told a visitor who was in touch with influential New York Democrats that he'd arrange that by imperceptible, comparatively, degrees, perhaps, military law which came into effect following the suspension of habeas corpus, might be made to relent. On November 22nd, the War Department ordered the release of most prisoners charged with discouraging enlistment or other disloyal conduct. Most blamed Republican defeats on what Lincoln called the ill success of the war. That failure they attributed to the president. Carl Schurz scolded the Lincoln administration for admitting its professed opponents to its councils. It placed the army, now a great power in this republic, into the hands of its enemies. Even more bluntly, a New Yorker charged that Lincoln's weakness, irresolution, and want of moral courage, which had kept traitors like McClellan and Buell in command, was responsible for the disgraceful outcome of the elections. Many prominent Republican politicians agreed. Immediately after the elections, several Pennsylvania congressmen came to the White House to report the outcome in their districts, and all blamed the general tardiness in military movements, for which they held McClellan and Buell responsible. Since Lincoln insisted on retaining these generals in command, J.K. Moorhead, the representative from the Pittsburgh district, told him candidly, "It wasn't your fault that we weren't all beaten." Some Pennsylvania Republican leaders, he continued, would be glad to hear some morning that you'd been found hanging from the post of a lamp at the door of the White House. Deeply depressed, the president responded in a subdued voice, "You needn't be surprised to find that that suggestion has been executed any morning." The violent preliminaries to such an event wouldn't surprise me. If Lincoln seriously feared violence, it wasn't from disappointed Republican politicians, but from the army. Ordinary soldiers and non-commissioned officers of the Union armies were nearly all loyal supporters of the government. But among officers, there was talk of a dictator to oust the marplots in the administration, like Stanton and Halleck, who allegedly failed to support the generals. Lincoln received few reports of such a mutinous spirit in the Western armies. He knew he could count on General U.S. Grant, in command of the Army of the Mississippi. Though a former Democrat, Grant expressed no interest in politics and no reservations about the president's emancipation policies. Instead, he concentrated his energies on defeating the Confederates. The Battle of Corinth, Mississippi, on October 3rd and 4th, in which Federal troops from his army, under the immediate command of General W.S. Rosecrans, repelled an attacking Confederate force, gave the president one of the few clear-cut Union victories in the last quarter of 1862. Nor did Lincoln doubt the loyalty of General Buell, who commanded the Army of the Ohio in central Tennessee. But he was often exasperated with that general, who was nearly as slow as McClellan, and he fumed when Buell resolutely ignored directives to invade mountainous eastern Tennessee, where Union loyalists lived under a Confederate reign of terror, and insisted on remaining in the Nashville region. In the fall, his unhappiness increased after two Confederate armies, under Braxton Bragg and Edmund Kirby Smith, launched an invasion of Kentucky, timed to coincide with Lee's raid into Maryland, and forced Buell to retreat to Louisville. His patience exhausted, Lincoln gave General George H. Thomas the command of the army, unless, at the time Thomas received his orders, Buell was actually preparing to fight.
This ends Disc 21.